Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Elveson from the Digital Education Podcast, where I get to have a little bit unscripted conversations with friends. And about a year ago, I had a conversation in one of my first podcasts with somebody who's been a great encouragement to me in this process. And then just professionally, since I've gotten to know him over the last 18 months, is Rex Miller. Rex is a futurist. He's a coach and consultant. He's an author of Humanizing the Education Machine and Healthy Workplace Nudge. Rex, I'm just going to jump right into it and just ask you this question, because you're kind of doing a mashup. I believe it's a little bit of a mashup project or mind shift project right now in combining Humanizing the Education Machine with Healthy Workplace Nudge and educators in the education profession. What are you learning about education, educators, and the health and well-being of educators?
It's a great question. Each of these, I would describe each mind shift initiative to be similar to a journey, kind of a fellowship of the rings. You know, we have this big question that we're looking at. We bring together a wide range of stakeholders, you know, experts, educators, community leaders, service providers. And you've participated in a few of the MindShift initiatives, specifically the one in Los Angeles. And so what we try to do is get underneath the layer. I mean, these are topics that are stuck, and they're stuck for a reason. And so we recognize that, one, no one entity or expert's going to be able to get to the root issue. And number two, it's not going to happen in a conference. And so our approach is designed specifically to get us out of what we call the expert mindset into the citizen mindset and come to these summits, go into an environment, and I'll use LA as an example. Our question there was, what do teachers on the front lines of some of the hardest places to teach, like South Central LA, how do they take care of themselves? And what do the schools do to take care of themselves? And as you remember, we went to this really incredible high school for homeless kids called RISE, where 50% of those kids actually graduate and go to college. And it's housed within, it's a really interesting concept. It's kind of a floating high school. They've got these schools inside what's called a wraparound services entity, called a place called home. And the kids are doing great. The environment is incredible. When I pulled away the head of the organization and I asked her, I said, so you know that some of these kids are going to go home and not have a great night. They're going to be on the streets, beat up. Some might not even show up the next day. I mean, that's got to weigh heavy. What do you do to take care of yourself? So her answer was, well, we can take a PTO and we have an on-site counselor. And I thought, wow, that's it? I mean, and so her explanation, and I get it, is that the mission and the purpose and the kids' lives that they touch is so motivating, but you can't just, that's not a long-term strategy. I mean, you can go so long on purpose and motivation and, but what do you do with the secondary trauma, you know, the hurts that those kids have? So that's one of the new questions we're asking. So the first book, Humanizing the Education Machine, was actually a bridge out of a workplace book on change your space, change your culture. You know, looking at how environments can improve culture and help in change and help some of the traditional resistance that comes with change. And then that led into, well, we've got the same problems in education. So this organization out of Florida called Meteor Education came to me and said, we want to do a book on this. And and in the book I explain, I'm not an educator. It's not my sweet spot. I don't have a business model for this. I'm not interested. And gave them a series of obstacles to overcome. And then, and they did. 8 months later, they come back and said, we've brought back the ruby slippers and the witch's broom. We survived all that. How do we get back to Kansas? And the next step was, well, let's invite all your friends, all the stakeholders and people, and let's do a trial summit to see how committed people are and how well we play together. And that was such a transformational effort that we dove into the education side. At the end of the education, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can I ask a question about that? Like, you start on the front end about talking about taking off kind of the mind shift processes, getting out of the expert mode and into the citizen mode. How did it help you, you know, in that first process to be able to say, hey, listen, I don't know anything about this. Like, this is not my area. Yeah. How did that help you go into that world to help them have those conversations?
So in my the process allows me to go from several different disciplines because the process is essentially designed to deal with humans in complexity, you know, human problems in a complex system. So it doesn't matter if it's a large construction project and we did a project and wrote a book on that. It doesn't matter if it's the church and adapting to culture. We had a process and did a book on that. It doesn't matter if it's workplace engagement and change or health and well-being or education. These are all modern human problems in systems of complexity. And my ignorance is probably my greatest asset. I'm the least informed participant in any of the projects we go into, but seeing the same human dynamics play out in these different elements help give me a little bit of a forecast on the common patterns that are going to show up here. I just have different ways to ask the question. And sometimes that's the most powerful part of getting a new conversation is asking the naive question that the experts already assume there are answers for. And so that's what allows me to go into this. Plus, and you've experienced it, bringing people together who generally want to have a different conversation, move the needle, and play well together. The fact that everybody comes and are willing to play well together is a big part of our ability to ask the different questions and go into areas that are off the reservation for most of us in terms of experience and knowledge. And be comfortable with being uncomfortable because we're with a group of people who are on this common journey.
So before I interrupted you, you were going to talk a little bit about the second project, you know, the Healthy Workplace Nudge. Like, so what have you learned about like workplaces and work and then this connection with education and schools and educators?
Well, so the conversation in workplace wellness really took a turn in 2013. And that was with a headquarters project for CBRE Richard Ellis there. CB Richard Ellis, they're a large commercial real estate brokerage firm. And they needed to reinvent themselves. They came out of the 2008 financial crisis, 2012. They're building a new space. They're going to team environments. Big culture shift for them. But they discovered a brand new process called the Well Building Standard, and it's the International Well Building Institute. It was the first time that medical science and building science came together and provided a framework for a project to build a measurably healthy building. So because that's the world I come out of, I covered that, looked at it, didn't really realize the significance until a year later when I they kept on ordering lots of books from the book called Change Your Space, Change Your Culture. So I went back to find out why, and this transformational experience in the morale, in the business, in the health outcomes. And when the managing director said, we've had 14,000 visitors in the last 18 months, my writer's instincts just perked up and said, there's a story here. So that journey started us looking at, so what is the health condition of corporate organizations? And we started with the general assumption that, you know, health insurance keeps going up, the healthcare system is lousy, insurance takes advantage of it, you know, the normal narrative. And then as we dug in, we set aside those assumptions and asked the naive questions again, and found that every single assumption we had about what's driving the health cost in the United States, about program, what works and what doesn't work in terms of corporate wellness, we had to throw completely out the door and start from scratch. And it led us to totally transforming insights and direction.
So how does that then translate to the project now that you're working on with educators? Like, so what have you learned just looking at educators, looking at their well-being, and looking at how just, you know, schools, our workplace, and just whatever it is with the design of the education system? Like, what have you learned so far as you go into, I think this next meeting you're having is to really kind of build and create the book. What have you discovered?
Well, so the big discovery in workplace is that all the effort on taking steps and eating better and all these incentives and education, all that, those don't work and they miss the point. When we were at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Ahmed Sood said the real villain to health is stress. And when he started sharing the numbers to us and basically saying that we've gotten the cart before the horse, so that unless we're dealing with root cause and human nature, so the root cause is stress, that drives all the unhealthy behaviors. Think about, you know, the big health cost drivers are eating too much of the wrong food, smoking, the abuse of drugs and alcohol, and sitting too much, you know, in front of TV, vegging, and all the digital distraction. That's driving 80% of our health costs. Those five behaviors comprise 80% of our health costs. And so we thought, wow, you know, it's really well-being or mental health is really the thing that we're going after. And then when we moved that conversation into to the education environment, we saw that it was even a bigger problem. Mental health issues in education, especially for the teachers, is the biggest problem that we face. It's the biggest threat to our education system. And that all the research that we've done for the last 40 years around trying to engage teachers, you know, the Gallup says 70% of teachers are disengaged, and by 12th grade, 60% of students have checked out. When we, you know, one seminal event, we looked at it and said, you know what, it's not the problem with teachers is not disengagement. They're burnout. They're stressed. They're depressed. They take twice as many medications for antidepressants than the rest of the population. And so it's like the battlegrounds. It's kind of like the, you know, what we learned in Iraq. The battlefield has changed so dramatically, and we've prepared our teachers for a previous era of winning hearts and minds. That's the battle. And now we're sending them in without the right equipment, without the right armor, without understanding self-care, without resiliency training, without school cultures and schedules structured for recovery, you know, output and recovery. And there is not a school or principal or place I've found yet that does this with intentionality as part of their strategy. They don't, you know, caring for the caregiver. So the problem was boiled down to, it's not that teachers don't care, which is the engagement question. It's that they care too much. And so we call it the caregiver's dilemma. And now we're in search of trying to find places that are healthy and happy, and what are they doing differently?
Well, and as you look at it, you know, and as you look at the future, you know, we look at the current situation where there's, I mean, the current labor report came out that was approximately 400,000, you know, too few teachers in the United States, that is just going to grow exponentially. That even in some recent research that parents even, you know, are, I mean, I think 10 years ago it was parents said 75% of parents said that they'd be happy if their kids became a teacher, and now it's closer to 30%. How do you even change the tide to even begin to get to a place where, you know, educators, teachers, people in schools are even at that place where they feel valued, or that their time is valued, and that they're, you know, that they're healthy, or we just starting from, are we just kind of going back to that place where we're starting from scratch and having new and completely different conversations?
Well, I think some of it is new and completely different conversations, but as you know, that's not going to happen fast enough at a scale that can make the big difference. So what we've been able to do is see pockets of help. And so these are proxies. When we connect the dots, these outliers become proxies for what it could look like. And so the theme from humanizing is there's this machine we get caught up in. And schools, at a school level, it's small enough you can humanize it, create community, you know, build in margin, tap into other kinds of assets like social capital, community assets. So the positive areas, the transformational areas that we saw in humanizing, like in Jennings, Missouri, or Eastlake, Georgia, or Corpus Christi, Texas, there was a lot of social capital built, connections with the community and community leaders and parents, and making this a village. You know, Lou Cozzolino talks about making the classroom like a small tribal experience. This human connection, Gallup's research talks about the importance of safe, you know, the child feeling safe and feeling connected and cared about and being given hope. So we're going back now to these universal human elements that leadership needs to help teachers move forward. And even in the work that, you know, I know you've focused on with John Hattie, this concept of collective efficacy. Leadership helping build hedges to protect, so that collective can be the force that brings this connection back to the school, rather than the top-down, rather than vertical mandates or outside programs. So I really think it comes back to everybody stepping back and stepping a little bit outside the machine and rehumanizing the classroom, rehumanizing the school, and connecting it to the bigger community. And that can be done anywhere. That doesn't take lots of money. It takes social and human capital.
So let me ask one last question then. We've talked education quite a bit, and educators can kind of get stuck in our own experience. In talking to the same people who are doing similar things, just maybe slightly different. How do we get unstuck in this process? Or if somebody's listening to this and they're a professional and they're an educator and they're a teacher,
right,
or they're a school leader and they just want to do something different, or they want to think about whether it's their classroom or, you know, just their department or their school, like, what suggestions would you have them give them to get unstuck from just getting the same answers to just layer on, you know, old things to new things and just do what we always do in education? How do you help people get unstuck in this situation?
Yes. the same way I did, 15 years ago when I was frustrated with the construction industry. You start out by finding people who are healthy people, equally frustrated, and begin talking. And for me, it was at a pancake house, once a month with colleagues, to talk and work through and then begin to expand that circle and go visit people doing good things and bring that back. It's the hero's journey, that call to adventure, building that small cohort, going off to see what others are doing, getting outside and inviting outsiders in to the conversation and continuing to expand that circle of people who want to make a difference, equally frustrated, but want to go on a journey together. And over time, that coalition gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I'm the least likely person to have gone into many of these areas. But that common frustration with a common interest in seeing the great value and need gets the conversation started. And then it begins to take a life of its own as long as you keep moving forward in the conversation and going outside your world to see what others are doing.
So maybe one last question, because you got to give me a new idea here. Give me a list of those places that you've been that just in the education world, yeah, or even in the work world, sure, that just kind of like inspire you from the inside, that say, you know what, they're moving in the right direction, or they're getting it, or you know what, that's what the future is going to look like. What are those places that you would say to people, hey, check this place out, check this place out?
Yeah, so Columbus, Indiana is the first stop, and there's an organization called Civic Lab. They are so good at what you might call public-private partnership, engaging community in education. Holland, Michigan is another bright spot because of their cooperative ecosystem of faith-based charter school and public school and the civic value. I would recommend reading the book Our Towns by James and Deborah Fallows, 30 communities that were reinvented and are vibrant, and education is a central story in all 30 of those cities. Atlanta, with Dr. Maria Karstafan, and El Paso is going through a revival right now. Da Vinci School in Los Angeles with RISE, the School for Homeless. So they're out there. I mean, there's just lots out there. But the key is to go and see them. Don't read about them. Go see and ask different questions. Don't ask what you're doing. Ask, how did you get away with doing it? How did you survive the board? How did you survive the budgets? How did you survive whatever? Those are the questions that are more important than how, because you see in what they do is really secondary to how they actually built it.
Rex, I really appreciate your time. Thanks a lot for everything, and excited for the
you're welcome, Eric,
to come out. We'll talk soon.
Thank you, Eric. Take care.